Hello, and welcome to episode 4 of Rational Security. The Cold War is hot. I am Shane Harris, your host of The Daily Beast. I am here joined, as always, by my friends Tamara Kaufman-Wittes of the Brookings Institution and World Traveler. Hello, Tamara.
Hi, Shane.
And my friend Benjamin Wittes, also of the Brookings Institution and noted road trip enthusiast. Hello, Ben.
Hi. Shane and I took a road trip last weekend.
We did take a road trip. And what did we do on that road trip? We ate lots of junk food.
We ate junk food, and we did stand-up comedy.
We did do stand-up comedy
for
together.
For the first time in my life, and we had a Twitter war.
We did have a Twitter war. We were misbehaving a lot during a conference that we went to in Lexington.
So much.
Yeah, we got busted by Tamara, who clearly saw that Ben and I should have been paying more attention to the very lucid and delightful panel before us. But
well, and I was starting to feel a little threatened by the budding bromance.
Were you? Really?
Just a little.
I thought you loved bromances.
I'm a bromance enthusiast.
You are a bromance enthusiast.
Bromance
That's
enthusiast.
That's how I should have introduced
tomorrow.
I should have gone with that. I went with the traveling theme, but really it's a bromance theme. This week on today's show, a lot of fun stuff in store. Crazy stories this week. Drones are falling from the sky. Is the president safe? We're going to talk about the links between autocracy and terrorism. And Russian spies who are apparently too dumb to watch CNBC or read any book by Michael Lewis. Why don't we start with Ben? Ben, take us off with your wordplay this week. A drone carrying meth crashed in Mexico. A drone crashed at 3 a.m. on the White House grounds, flown by a drunk intelligence agency employee. Please explain why drones are falling from the sky with methamphetamines and trying to kill the president.
So, first of all, it was a bad week for drones. It was only a matter of time before the drug cartels started to try to move meth over the border using drones. I think they will continue to try, but this first episode was not all that successful. And so in northern Mexico, we had a drone crash, and looks like they just tried to put a little too much on the drone. And, you know, these...
Were they drunk, too, when they were flying?
We don't know. We don't know who they were, but the...
High on meth, probably.
But the drones, those payload limits are actually pretty serious, and if you exceed them, they will not fly properly. Back a couple years ago, when I tried to organize a drone dogfight through Lawfare, which was, we called the Lawfare Drone Smackdown, my kids and I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what our drone could actually carry. And the answer was very little. You know, the rotors are very unstable if they're not perfectly balanced. And so you can't actually overload it relative to its payload capacity. And this poor drone, I think, just was more meth than a poor drone can bear.
Sad little drone.
It's really tragic. So it went down.
And all
is it subject
meth.
To mandatory minimums?
Well, it's going to get deported, you know.
they don't even give it a trial. It no was, due process no for drones?
Exactly. So, and then a few days later, you know, that was the sort of weird, creepy story, drone story of the week. But then it really had to take a back seat to the 3 a.m. drunk intelligence community officer from the National Geospatial Agency who, as John Stewart said, don't drone drunk, drunk droning, decided the right thing to do at 3 a.m. was to do some surveillance of the White House. So that drone appears also to have crashed. Contrary to a story in Defense One yesterday, which seemed to suggest that it may have been taken down by White House drone jamming software. It seems to have died of natural causes.
And can I just say, this makes me sad, not simply because the drone died, but it would have been so badass if the White House had a drone Wi-Fi jammer just on all the time in case somebody flew a drone nearby.
Your kids had one at the Drone Smackdown.
That's right. Indeed. So this is an important thing. First of all, you know, drone Wi-Fi signal jamming is not hard.
Right.
And if anybody looks at Lawfare this week, I reposted the section from the discussion of the Drone Smackdown of how we did that Wi-Fi jamming.
Well, you're still so proud of that.
I'm pretty proud of it.
It was really cool. I was there refereeing that, and it was pretty sweet to see, actually.
And so I think, and the interesting thing about that drone jamming was that we learned how to do it not from any technical expertise, but from a YouTube search. And I wanted to figure out how I could take out a Wi-Fi signal. And I figured there would be some cheap Wi-Fi jamming product that I could buy. But in fact, there is just an app you can download for an Android device that turns your Android device into a system that will take down virtually any Wi-Fi network, including the ones that these drones operate on. Now, some of them operate on more sophisticated radio channels, but almost any radio broadcast can be jammed. And so I think they're really... Actually, the Defense One story, though it didn't describe what happened here, really does describe what how you might protect an area against cheap invasion by cheap small drones. And, you know, I'm sure that a sophisticated military or a sophisticated force can build all sorts of defenses around it. But if you're relying on cheap over-the-air stuff, you are pretty vulnerable to that kind of jamming. So, but here's the reason I bring all these drones up, other than drones falling out of the sky just being kind of badass and cool, which is Gabby Blum and I have just written a book called, and you should all buy it, by the way, it's called The Future of Violence. It is about the dissemination and proliferation of technologies of attack and surveillance from the state level down to the level of individuals and small groups and criminal gangs and just individual scary people. And so here we had, in the space of a week, two incidents, one in which Mexican drug traffickers are using drones, and the second in which somebody is triggering a Secret Service latest Secret Service incident using drones. Both seem to be relatively harmless for now, but it makes you wonder, how long is it before people are using small unmanned aerial vehicles for things that are much less amusing and much more terrifying these two incidents?
So what are we really worried about in this context? I mean, we were just talking about how this drone in Mexico crashed because it's overloaded with the payload, and so it seems sort of, at least in the current context of this rotocopter, or this quadcopter, I guess it was, that they used, you're not going to have somebody with an explosive payload loaded onto it, right? But like, but talk about how...
Well, but what about like an aerosolized bioweapon?
Yeah,
that doesn't weigh very much.
Or how trivially easy is it to get just a little bit of a stronger drone? And like, in other words, how hard would it have been for somebody who wasn't just drunk and screwing around, presumably on the roof of an apartment building across from the White House, to have actually loaded something up here that could have done damage to people?
So, first of all, I would not exclude the possibility of the delivery of an explosive payload. You know, a medium-sized drone can carry a payload of a few pounds. That's certainly what Amazon is talking about with their, you know, delivery systems. A few pounds of explosives is a substantial problem, depending on where you land and detonate it. Secondly, I do think that the point that Tamara makes is exactly right. If you imagine, and this is one of the examples that Gabby and I use in the introduction to our book, what if the anthrax attacks, rather than having been sent in sealed envelopes and labeled, you know, now we have anthrax, go get Onsipro. What if you'd taken a small UAV and flown it over a stadium? Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that is, you know, that's not necessarily a whole lot of weight.
The panic alone would have been tremendous.
Would have been tremendous. And I think these sorts of attacks, and I don't want to, you know, don't want to give anybody any ideas about them, but I do think the more you have the capacity to do these kinds of flights, the more you have to ask the question, who's going to use them for what, and how scared should we be of that? And then finally, if Gabby were here, she would add something else, which is, what happens when the drones are much smaller even than this? And that you're talking about an insect-sized drone, perhaps that could deliver a lethal payload in the form of an injection of some kind of a poison. The example that Gabby always uses is you find a spider in your bathtub, and maybe you don't know if it's a real spider or a robotic spider. Now, that sounds like a fantasy, but if you had said 10 years ago that a drunk agency employee is going to be flying a UAV over the White House at 3 in the morning, that would have sounded like a right. fantasy, too. And these things are becoming smaller and more powerful by the three-month period. And so I do think you got to think about it.
You know, I want to play a little bit of a devil's advocate. I don't want to downplay the threat too much, but, you know, the drunken droner or the ill-thought-out drug smuggling attempt isn't that different in terms of threat profile or common sense countermeasures than people with unvaccinated kids going to a crowded place like Disneyland. It's a foreseeable challenge, and we know what appropriate countermeasures are, but for what, and in the case of the drunken droner, but for whatever reason, the Secret Service had not thought to put those countermeasures in place, just as we know that everybody should be vaccinated. And if they're not, then we're going to have disease outbreaks when people who, you know, willfully don't vaccinate their kids show up in crowded places. So if that continues to be a trend, we need to start, you know, enforcing vaccination requirements if we want to prevent those disease outbreaks. Isn't this a manageable threat, at least up to a certain level?
Well, so I think with the caveat, at least up to a certain level, obviously, yes. And if you stopped the development of drone technology where it is today, then I think you could say the worst that would happen is you'd have some hobbyists who, with some accidents, and look, there was a kid in New York killed by his drone. It came down and severed his artery, and he died. And I have a video of a rodeo event in Virginia in which was being filmed by a drone that decided to crash into the stands and, you know, hurt somebody. So it won't be completely casualty-free, but it's at a entirely manageable level of accidents and certainly very limited attack capability. I think the problem is, and the scary thing is, that the technology is developing very quickly. And like all computer-based technology, it sort of seems to develop at an exponential rate in terms of power and capability. And one thing that people are really, really good at is figuring out how to use new technologies to kill each other. And that's, you know, that's just something that we seem to do kind of effortlessly. And I find it hard to believe that the power of remote standoff flight will not be used by individuals, just as it has been used by militaries, to do nasty things to one another, among its many other positive uses.
Yeah, one thing I found so interesting in conversation I had actually with a cab driver, which are among usually the most interesting conversations you have in Washington.
Certainly if you ask Tom Friedman.
Is that, yeah, he's into this too. I was talking to cab drivers way before Tom Friedman, if you're listening.
Trendsetter.
Sure I was. But no, this guy was talking to me, and he said, you know, can you believe this thing about this drone crashing on the south lawn of the White House? And I thought he was going to say something of like, you know, maybe kind of like what Ben was just talking about, like, can you believe all these different ways people have to kill us? His first reaction was, and they want us to believe at the White House that they have these missiles that could shoot down a plane if it was coming for Washington. What a crock. And it was interesting how this event had convinced this guy that actually we were totally unsecure and that all the things that have been built up after 9/11 that we want to believe are here in the air defense systems, which there are air defense systems in Washington where that's been documented. He thought that was just all for show and that this was sort of finally the act that pierced the veil of this security theater and demonstrated, and he'd say probably not incorrect in being suspicious given how many people have shot at the White House recently, but you know, that it reminded him of how insecure he believes that we actually are. And I just thought it was not the reaction that I had, it was sort of a counterintuitive one, but it makes a lot of sense. If a drone can get through to the White House, then, you know, why not something bigger, right?
So I think it's wrong.
I think the
example that shows that it's wrong, you both remember, I'm sure, when that weird German guy, Bayard Rustin, flew a Cessna.
Yeah, an actual plane.
An actual plane through the Soviet air defenses and landed it on Red Square.
Well, I thought you were talking about the guy who crashed into the White House.
No. That was a different...
He was not a strange German.
Yeah, he was not a strange German. Oh.
They're always up to this. You could see why I was confused.
It was a small plane, and he flew it from Germany and just kept going and landed it in Red Square. And, you know, the Soviet air defenses were not built for something that small. And, you know, it was very embarrassing to them. But I don't think it actually showed that they couldn't have repelled a major NATO attack, for example. So there's some de minimis lower threshold that, you know, defense systems aren't meant to protect against.
Well, I don't know. I fully expect that the White House air defense system is now going to be building a full-scale drone defense system, and the contract for this is going to be mega. Oh,
well, yeah. They should just go to Lawfare and look up how to turn their Android device into, because, you know...
Drone killing is cheap and easy.
It's not hard.
And you know the other thing's going to happen, too, is I spent about 20 minutes yesterday calling apartment buildings nearby the White House, figuring it was sort of like, you know, there's one.
There aren't any close.
There's a couple, yeah, there's like a couple within a block or two. And actually, the building I used to live in D.C. is managed by that company owns it. So I called and I said, has people in the lobby, has the Secret Service been calling you? But it makes me wonder if now they're going to be looking at, you know, well, this roof deck is a problem, or what are these balconies that are facing the White House? I mean, presumably the range on a quadcopter is not that far, so with somebody, if you...
Some of those little guys can fly pretty far.
Well, I mean,
there's an incredible, I forget which of the drone companies, an incredible set of videos that one of the companies had a competition among their users for, like, the best videos you could take with your drone. And some guy flew it all the way across Niagara Falls, in through the mist. There were flights over the Grand Canyon.
Just the guy who flew it through fireworks in some city, too.
Yeah. I mean, some of these things have pretty good range, and they have a fair degree of autonomy in their flight, too.
Oh, boy. Okay. Tamara, Freedom House's annual Freedom in the World Report has just been released. It highlights the links between autocracy and terrorism. So the question is, does democratic growth have anything to do with American national security? Tell us the answer in your wordplay.
Sure. Well, I was fortunate to be one of the speakers at the launch event for the Freedom House annual report. And, you know, they do these rankings of every country in the world assessing on a 14-point scale, are they free, partly free, or not free? And one of the big themes of their report this year was that terrorism is both a consequence of repressive governance and a result. a driver and a consequence, a cause and an effect. And their argument is that the lack of democratic governance creates an enabling environment for terrorism. And also that governments exploit terrorist threats as a justification for repressive measures. And the second part, I think, is fairly obvious and non-controversial. But the first part, I think, is worthy of a little bit of exploration. It's certainly true, as they demonstrated with their statistics, that well over 90% of the deaths due to terrorism over the last year took place in countries they had designated as not free. But I think the relationship is actually a little more complex than they describe. And, you know, ISIS is a great example here, that this is a violent extremist movement that emerged as a result of state failure. The weakness and ultimate breakdown of political institutions in Iraq, the alienation of Sunnis from institutions that were not functioning for them, and then Syria, of course, collapsing into civil conflict, and terrorist safe havens emerge very frequently in situations of sustained conflict and conflict zones. So it's just a good reminder that if we want to address terrorism in a fundamental way, not just sort of beat back a threat that will then become resurgent as soon as we're no longer paying attention or applying force, we have to pay attention to the governance structures. And even if the United States, after the experience of the last decade plus in Iraq and Afghanistan, is understandably reluctant to be in this state-building business, somebody has got to be in the state-building business if we don't want terrorist movements to just spring back up.
So does this prove the neocons right, then?
I don't know that it's quite that simple, because obviously functioning political institutions don't sort of jump off the tanks that come in the midst of a counterterrorism campaign, or in the case of the anti-ISIS campaign, the F-16, since we have no tanks in Iraq or Syria. But I do think it's worth paying closer attention in a preventive sense, not just in a sort of post-conflict sense. You know, what can be done in cases where we already have fragile states, you know, whether it's a fragile democracy like Tunisia, which is still really kind of finding its sea legs. Are there more things we can do to reward democratic progress and strengthen political institutions? Or if you have a place like Venezuela, where, you know, oil prices are falling and the Venezuelan state may well face tremendous challenges just maintaining basic functions in the face of this, is our role just to step back and smile at that? Or should we worry about the consequences of that in terms of violence, civil conflict, and potential national security threats?
Okay, but Tamara, there's the natural response to this is it's not 2002. And we can look around the world and say there's a relationship between authoritarianism and all sorts of bad outcomes, both a causal and an effect relationship. But there's also a relationship at least as strong between the effort to do anything about that and even worse outcomes, whether it's in Iraq or in all these countries that we were very excited about as a sort of Arab Spring matter that then turn out to be really bad. And so my question is, and I agree with you that in the long run, you need to democratize, you need to have more freedom in order to avoid stoking ideologies that are you know, terrible and that produce bad stuff. But what about the action problem?
Okay, so I think those are two very, very different categories of cases that you just laid out. And I understand the tendency to overgeneralize from Iraq, but there is no other case in this post 9/11 era where the United States looked at an autocratic government and said the mere existence of this autocratic government presents a threat to American national security so dire that we're going to mount a massive invasion.
Well, there is a case, which is the Taliban.
Okay, it wasn't the autocratic nature of the Taliban. It was the direct cooperation between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, which carried out the 9/11 attacks. There was no such direct link in the Iraq case. The argument that the Bush administration made about Iraq was that the nature of this government is that it is so far outside international norms on domestic behavior and international behavior, it's got such a bad track record that it simply cannot be tolerated. The potential for threats to emerge is so great, and the threats that might emerge are so grave that we cannot tolerate the possibility, and we must go do something about it now. It was a preventative argument. Very different and very singular, I would argue. Now, the Arab Spring, I think, is an entirely different question. First, because there's not a problem of action here. This was not a case where the United States was going in and toppling governments. Most of these governments, let's remember, were strategic partners of the United States. And nothing hampered American security policy in the Middle East more than the fall of Hosni Mubarak. Nothing scared American national security professionals about their ability to operate in the Middle East more than the fall of Hosni Mubarak and what might follow. But the other thing to remember is that Egypt had a terrorism problem under Mubarak. It wasn't the fall of Mubarak that created the insurgency that now exists in Sinai. It is, however, the very repressive approach that the current Egyptian government has taken toward that low-level insurgency that has exacerbated it into a much bigger problem that we have today. But Mubarak had terrorism problems. He could not resolve them himself, and his successors are facing the same challenges. So I just don't see a problem there with respect to external intervention in the same way.
No, but there is, you know, with the exception of Tunisia, there is no real example, and I'm not sure Tunisia is an example. It's a good example of liberalization, but I'm not sure there's a good example of the common sense proposition that, you know, if you liberalize, you reduce, you reduce the capacity of states to produce terrorist threats and you know, and other bad things.
Look, I think it is a very good point that we don't yet have a clear case, except in, you know, in countries that are already in an environment where their neighbors and those who have strong influence over them are already democracies, where conflict resolution has vastly reduced terrorism. And, you know, Northern Ireland, I think, would be probably the most important case to single out in that regard. It's not that, you know, terrorism disappeared entirely with the Good Friday Accords, but it the rug was pulled out from under those who were continuing to use that tool. They were marginalized and ultimately ostracized to the point of irrelevance. And that, I think, is the goal. Not that you completely eliminate the problem, but that you you really reduce or eliminate the permissive environment for the problem.
I'm staying out of this one.
It's wittis v. wittis, and Shane is just watching the action.
Well, I don't know if it's wittis v. wittis. It's wittis believer versus wittis head scratcher.
Or wittis skeptic versus wittis optimist.
Which is that the usual dynamic too? I mean, you strike me as both fairly optimistic.
Well, not when we talk about torture.
Oh, okay.
Joke.
Which is all the time.
Joke.
Right, you're pro torture, right?
Right. Well, I'm wittis smiler and you're wittis skeptic.
Yeah, you know, I'm very skeptical of torture.
Just for the record, we're not being serious.
Noted torture apologist.
Noted torture
ben
apologist.
Wittis. All right, time for my wordplay. And actually, I'm very excited because this is going to involve a short dramatic reading. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
I can hardly wait.
Hello, Evgeny. Can you talk? I need help. Tass wants very much. I don't know how it came down from the top, but they need three questions with regard to New York Stock Exchange. What would be interesting to us? Can you help write something? So that is a recorded transcript. Yes, and it sounds just like that. This is a transcript from the FBI intercepting the conversation between Evgeny Buryakov, also known as Zenya, which I thought was a clothing store.
Those tricky Russian nicknames.
And Igor Sporyshev. So Igor Sporyshev was is now no longer in the United States, a Russian intelligence officer in the United States undercover as a Russian diplomat. And Evgeny Buryakov was a banker in Manhattan in the United States under non-official cover, a so-called illegal, who was arrested 2 days ago in New York in this bust-up of a Russian spy ring. This is the first one that we've had since the breakup of the 10 spies with Anna Chapman. Everyone remembers her, the very glamorous spy back in, I guess it was 2010, which inspired the show The Americans, which is coming back. Very excited. And why I was fascinated by this bit of this story and why I chose to read this is that So as we reported in the Daily Beast yesterday, this was on Tuesday, these guys were somehow feeding questions to the TASS news agency, the Russian state-owned news agency, apparently to allow their journalists or help their journalists ask questions in interviews of people who knew things about the New York Stock Exchange, so that this could be then fed back to the economic intelligence section of the SVR, of the Russian intelligence agency.
That's so tricky. You get journalists to ask questions on the record?
Can you believe it?
And then you can use the information they produce?
You can use that.
Wow.
The Russians have just figured out this dastardly ploy. I mean, you got to be kidding me with this.
You know what? You got to be kidding me with that accent, Shane. I'm sorry.
Oh, come on. Oh, it's a little too Hungarian, maybe.
But I
like read Flash Boys. Like read. I mean, they wanted to know about things like electronic transfer trading system, trading robots. I mean, this is. I mean, it's just Google it.
Right.
What in the world?
Or apply to Harvard Business School.
Right. I also think it's just fantastic that like TASS is still. Like shilling for the, you know, the SVR. I interviewed the former KGB general who ran U.S. operations, and he was like, I worked for Radio Moscow as the U.N. correspondent in 1959. All my friends were at TASS. Nothing has changed. It was great.
The Cold War is hot. But I think we need to send the SVR a let me Google that for you link.
Seriously.
Oh, definitely.
You know.
Yeah. And on a serious note, I should say, like, look, okay. Counterintelligence professionals who I know and, you know, would tell you that there are sophisticated Russian operations working inside the United States. There are sophisticated Russian cyber operations working against, you know, the U.S. government, U.S. companies. And in this, you know, fairly only 20-some page complaint, the government may have been picking out the most ridiculous instances on which they were going to charge these guys because they don't want to give away maybe some of the other sophisticated plots they're watching. But really, if, like, this is, you know, the creme de la creme of, you know, Russian intelligence running against the U.S. financial system. I mean, maybe we should just totally breathe easy because this is just, these guys were,
well, but
it seems like an idiotic ploy.
And well, it's the second big Russian spy ring that's been broken up that seems clownish. Anna Chapman's
Pink Panther-like clownish.
The first.
Yeah, well, and you also just have to wonder, I mean, presumably it takes years of preparation and thousands of dollars of investment and government investment to place somebody like this non-official cover guy. I mean, it's just like Jack Ryan and Jack Ryan's Shadow Recruit, right? He's working secretly for the CIA at a Wall Street firm. And the idea that this is what they would use him for? I mean, it's kind of like you send a guy to go get a PhD in astrophysics and then ask him to make you an egg salad sandwich.
Exactly. I mean, this is somebody who was here on non-official cover, which means that he has no connections back to the government. This is supposed to be one of your most valuable intelligence assets that you have. Why use him for something? And what's also interesting, and I almost wonder if, you know, I'm sure, I don't know if this was deliberate, but I'm sure that the FBI and the Justice Department were cackling as they wrote this complaint. Because that conversation that I was, you know, interpreting for you was one
that's
of the
a generous word.
Yeah, was one of the few instances in which these guys actually broke operational security and talked on the phone, and so this became one of the sort
this
of
this is
pieces.
How they caught them.
This is not how they caught them, but it's one of the it was one of the few instances where they broke, and it revealed a lot of things. It revealed that there were orders coming from the top. It revealed that Sporyashev was running Buryakov. It revealed that TASS was involved. I mean, there was a lot of, in that conversation, was a
well,
lot
Well, now I understand. This is all part of a secret plot to persuade us that the Russians are bumbling fools.
It's a very persuasive case that they make, you know? And so it's always like, it was like this, they were almost with, you know, gleefully talking about, like, the one time that they broke operational security and had to do it in, like, 15 minutes because apparently somebody in Moscow just really wanted to know about trading robots or something.
Okay, so here's my question. Because this is what people are talking about right now today in both Langley and Moscow, which is, what's the trade?
Right. Right.
You know, whatever you roll them up for, somebody who has non-official cover who's real, Moscow cares about a lot. They value bringing back their people, and that means you can get something in exchange for them. So
Do we know any people who are of interest to the American intelligence community currently living in Moscow who we might want to get back?
You know, but you,
I wonder.
But you, no, no, but I think you usually trade.
You trade for one of your own spies.
You trade for one of your own spies,
usually.
not for somebody you want to punish. So I don't think it's likely, we're likely to see Snowden's residency revoked over this. But I think you do have to, just in the currency of Cold War is hot kind of negotiations, we just rolled something up that they will want to get back. And the question is, what do we get in exchange for it? And what are we asking for in exchange for it? And it does come at a time when, you know, Putin is, you know, got a lot on his plate, and he does not need an escalation with us in a number of areas. And so I think there's, you know, all jokes aside, there's a possibility that this isn't not insignificant strategic benefit to the United States in the bilateral relationship.
And so, you know, it raises the question, I guess, and this is where, I guess, the reporting needs to go next, is who is Evgeny Buryakov? I mean, who is this person so valuable, as he's so well-placed? Would the Russians be afraid that if they left him here, he would give up even more information about Russians in the country under non-official cover, which are, you know, the deepest of the deep? And would they be willing to trade Snowden for it? I mean, I think you're, you have to believe that there are people right now at least thinking about the possibility of, what if we actually use this to get him back, to get Snowden back?
I mean, it is hard for me to believe. So first of all, I wasn't actually thinking of Snowden when I raised it. No.
I was thinking of imprisoned Americans.
I was thinking of, you know,
or imprisoned Russian spies who'd worked for the CIA.
Right. I mean, look how quickly the, you know, the Anna Chapman ring was traded back once they were rolled up.
Right.
And the fact that they were clownish did not make them invaluable as an exchange currency. This group is, you know, I mean, worth something. And the question is how much. I can't imagine you would get anything as valuable as Edward Snowden in exchange for it. But there may be people in prison in Russia who will suddenly find that this is the best thing that's ever happened to them.
Wow. Well, you know, if the Cold War is back, I'm just a little bit sorry that we won't have the visuals of Checkpoint Charlie for the exchange of prisoners.
We should have a set built.
We should, just for this purpose. But I will tell you that the next time someone from TASS shows up at my Brookings event and asks a question, I will be paying very close attention.
You should pay.
And we can ask, you know, who asked you to ask that question.
That's right.
Who tasked you?
Who Itar tasked you?
Yeah, who Itar tasked you?
Oh.
Was it my friend Boris or Natasha? All right. I'm going to spare you any more dramatic reenactments. Maybe that could be like a podcast extra. Let's move on to object lesson. Ben, why don't you kick us off?
Well, I have a very special object, except that it's not quite here yet. It's in the mail. Listeners will remember in our first episode, I told the story of my little NSA coin and the fact that I had been the Constitution Day speaker at NSA, but my speech for which I had asked for the audio was still under declassification review and had not yet been cleared for release, though I cannot possibly give a classified speech since I am not cleared to receive classified information myself. Well, it is the power, I think, of listener protests, I'm sure, that NSA was bombarded with requests for my speech. No, I don't know that to be true. Randomly, perhaps because they heard episode one, I received notice the other day that my speech had been cleared and that a DVD is in the mail with my September Constitution Day speech.
Did they redact any of your own remarks?
I believe it was cleared in its entirety, and we're going to run it as an episode of the Lawfare podcast,
nice.
Constitution Day in January, February. It's a little late, keep an ear out. And so my object is a DVD that is traveling in the mail as we speak.
It is virtual, and I don't want to believe that this is not a coincidence that they actually heard and we're shamed into speeding up the declassification.
No, I think
process.
This is clearly an example of the impact that this podcast
clearly.
Is going to have.
The power yeah. of the
some
podcast.
Some metadata filter caught this yes. in, you know, someplace and said, ooh, let's listen to that podcast. And we did determine that you didn't say anything in the speech about, like, security procedures for getting in the building or anything like, you know, the way the windows look or something. There was nothing in the speech that could have even remotely raised a concern about.
Well, there was the part where I talked about how, you know, Admiral Rogers, you know, had those mics planted on. No, I'm kidding.
Aside from that,
no, there was nothing remotely sensitive yeah. in the speech. You know, I think, you know, had I asked, as I said a couple of weeks ago, had I asked for the Q&A portion of the speech, that could have involved some sensitivity because people right. did say things that could conceivably identify them. But I didn't. I specifically asked only for my remarks. And I think it was just caught in a kind of a lot of the same bureaucratic rigmarole that everything has to go through in order to get out of that building. And that's, you know, one of the reasons it's so hard for them to talk in the public arena.
Yeah, yeah. Well, your words are free and on the way. Tamara, what is your object this week?
Okay, well, I am holding here and will share with all of you a photograph of my not very expensive blue fountain pen. And I want to use this fountain pen not merely to point out that I am a real sentimentalist, that I still write with a fountain pen, but also to make a proposal to the two of you,
uh-oh.
Shane and Ben. As some of our really attentive listeners or listeners who are also Twitter users might have noticed, Ben has been tweeting at House of Cards, the House of Cards Twitter account, tweeting about the Rational Security podcast and getting responses.
And from House of Cards?
From House of Cards, indeed. So President Underwood seems to be paying attention to the Rational Security podcast. Last week, Ben pointed out that the podcast episode revealed that I was a broadsword enthusiast, and he posed the question whether Frank Underwood was as well. And House of Cards replied, noting that the pen is mightier than the sword, but that they keep their options open, which, of course, President Underwood always does. So I just wanted to say I agree that the pen is mightier than the sword. In fact, my blue fountain pen is mightier than my broadsword.
And both hang on are in your office.
And both hang out in my office. But I would like to nominate President Frank Underwood as the patron saint of the Rational Security podcast.
Well, I think I second this nomination. And I want to point out that the Rational Security Twitter feed has begun sending President Underwood interview questions on matters of national security. The first question that we sent was whether he supports closing Guantanamo. We're going to see whether House of Cards responds. And if does, we'll see what President Underwood thinks about drone strikes. We'll see all
and drunk droning.
And drunk drone and drones on the White House lawn. Lots of questions. So if you guys have questions for national security questions for President Underwood, tweet them at the Rational Security Podcast, and we will try to keep this interview going, and we'll see how much we can pin Frank Underwood down on the critical national security, legal, and other questions facing America.
Yeah, well, he has a big season ahead of him. Obviously, House of Cards comes back with President Underwood, so let's challenge him. Let's do it. Okay, right on. So my object lesson, actually, I'm going back to episode one of Rational Security as well. So listeners will remember that I had brought in a rock, which was sort of a long story about talking about how my family had recently come upon my grandfather's World War II records. And I had been looking for these when I was young and never was able to find them. So they finally arrived in the mail. I had them shipped back to my grandmother's house. And it's an astonishing amount of paperwork. It's really something. A friend of mine who is a lawyer with a lot of experience looking through very old records, of his own grandfather, actually. We got together the other night and looked at these, and he said, you know, the things that you're finding here you never would have found in a FOIA request. And so the object actually I brought in today is a copy of his pilot's log, where you can actually open it up, and you can see, you know, there's his name. He died before I was born,
wow.
I should note, too. We have the same middle name. in my grandfather's handwriting, all the day-to-day that he actually went through to be trained in how to fly various cargo aircraft. And it's just, it's really, I mean, it's the reason this is really interesting for me personally is, you know, these are sort of very tangible links to someone I never knew and who really my family never really told a lot of stories about, other than they said that, you know, you would have gotten along with him very well, which is, you know, not saying a lot. I'm sure we would have, but I'm something of a World War II buff as well. So I brought this in, A, just to sort of show people,
you know,
what was had come out of that. But the more, to me, interesting thing is his flight rosters and the rosters of the people that he flew with and photographs of the people he flew with were also found in the records. So what I am going to undertake, and I'll tweet about this on my own Twitter feed at Shane Harris, and maybe we'll talk about it more on the podcast later, I'm going to try and find, if they are still alive, the people who flew with him.
You know, Shane, I'm sensing a book in this.
There could be something in the offing.
Could be At War, Part 2, with Granddad.
At War with Granddad. The time
the
traveler.
Prequel.
The prequel. Exactly. It's going to be like the 4th, 5th, and 6th Star Wars movies. So I will, on my own Twitter feed, I'll tweet out some photographs of these people and try to find them. So follow me at Shane Harris, and maybe we'll do it on the Rational Security Twitter feed as well. And if you recognize anyone in these photos or their names, please contact me and let me know, and maybe I could find some really cool stories about my grandfather. So that brings us to the end of the episode. Tomorrow, would you like to tell everyone where to find us after they're finished listening to this episode 4?
You can find us on Facebook at Spaghetti on the Wall Productions. Please like us on Facebook. If you are on iTunes and that's where you download the podcast, please give us a 5-star review. And we look forward to seeing you next time.
Follow us on Twitter as well at RATL Security. You can also follow Tamara at TC Wittes, WITTES. You can follow me at Benjamin Wittes, all strung together like it's one word. And you can follow Shane at Shane Harris. Rational Security is a production of Spaghetti on the Wall Productions. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Our editor is the estimable Jennifer Howell.
That's it. Thank you for listening to episode 4. I'm Shane Harris. On behalf of my friends Benjamin Wittes and Tamara Kaufman Wittes, we will see you next week.